You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Ramsey Canan. 75 years ago today, on July the 19th, 1936, the radicals of Spain rose up against a fascist coup led by Francisco Franco. Today, the Spanish Civil War is largely known and remembered by those valiant folks who answered the call to fight fascism with the international brigades from across the world. Perhaps less known, but equally inspiring, is the thoroughgoing revolution that up to 10 million Spanish workers and peasants were engaged in concurrent to the Civil War. Few people are as qualified to talk about the Spanish Revolution and its importance as longtime Scottish anarchist, writer and publisher Stuart Christie. Christie is the author of numerous books, including We the Anarchists, about the Spanish Anarchist Federation, the FAI, or Federation of Anarchists of Iberia. I should also disclose that I have published works by Mr. Christie. As a young man, Stuart was arrested and imprisoned for attempting to assassinate the Spanish dictator, Francisco Franco. So, this being the anniversary of the Spanish Revolution, why is it a revolution? Or rather, what's the difference between the Spanish Revolution and the Spanish Civil War?
Well, the Spanish Civil War, basically what happened on July the 17th, 1936, was that the Spanish military classes, with the backing of the church and the phalange and the industrialists, they launched what they hoped would be a traditional pronunciamiento, a coup d'etat, which had happened previously in the past without any proper real resistance. But it just so happened that the CNT, the Anarcho-Syndicalist Labour Union, was ready for them, and they had years of preparation for that moment. And the defense committees of the CNT, which were sort of the active rank-and-file militants, they were aware that this coup d'etat was about to be launched, and they were actually, they had advanced knowledge of it from round about the 13th of July. So basically, when the military marched out of the garrisons in the mornings of in the late 18th of July and the early morning of the 19th of July, the defense committees and the activists were waiting for them. For example, in Barcelona, they had two command posts ready outside the barracks, and the barricades went up, and the whole thing turned into a complete disaster. So what was should have been a straightforward coup d'etat turned into a thwarted pronunciamiento, which in turn became a civil war. But at the same time as it became a civil war, it unleashed a social revolution, which had been prepared for by the CNT since, well, for many years.
So let's backtrack slightly then. So the CNT, so who were and what was the CNT?
Well, the CNT was an anarcho-syndicalist labor union which had been founded in 1911, and it had gone through various periods of clandestinity and legality and semi-legality.
And this was because of the response of the state to their organizing?
Because of the state, yeah. I mean, during the period of, from the period 1911 up until 1916, 15, when it was legalized again, it was made illegal shortly after it was launched. And it reappeared in 1916, I think. And it then faced, because of the influence that it wielded amongst the industrial working classes and also among the agrarian workers across Spain, especially, you know, in Andalusia and Extremadura and elsewhere, it became public enemy number one for the employers. So that by 1917-18, the Employers' Confederation decided to counter it by employing pistoleros. These were organized gangsters whom they used to bump off the leading militants of the day over the period between 1919-1918-1923, around, you know, maybe 300-400 of Spain's leading anarcho-syndicalists had been murdered.
Can you explain or clarify what is anarcho-syndicalism I mean, you said they were influenced in both industry, but also in agriculture. So can you define for us what is anarcho-syndicalism?
Anarcho-syndicalism is it's basically trade, you know, labor union influenced by anarchist ideas of self-management and the idea that ultimately the workers will take over and run the industries themselves, both the land and the industries and the workshops, in self-managed units.
And so how, other than the ideology of the union, was the way that they organized internally was also anarchist? Was that a one of the defining features of that? I mean, when one thinks of labor unions, one thinks of a kind of top-down bureaucracy, of the bureaucrats functioning. Is this the way that an anarcho-syndicalist union runs?
No, an anarcho-syndicalist union would be, it'd be very similar in many ways to the IWW. They organized by industry, and they were organized by factory and by barrio, but basically, you know, they were held together by what was the affinity groups, the people who were the committed, ideologically committed anarchists. Not everyone who was in the CNT was necessarily an anarchist. In fact, it attracted people from across the whole of the political and social and religious spectrum. But the glue that kept the CNT together was, in fact, the anarchist movement and the ideology of anarchism.
You've written in your book, We the Anarchists, of the Spanish Anarchist Federation, called the FAI.
Yeah.
Why were they formed, and what was their influence on this wider movement?
Well, the FAI itself didn't come into existence until many years later, after the CNT was formed. In fact, it didn't come into existence until 1927. And the reason it came into existence was primarily to prevent the anarcho-syndicalist basis of the CNT being diluted by reformist influences, people who wanted to convert the union into what was effectively a political party. They wanted to ensure that the anarchism remained the key driving force and within the union, and that the ultimate objective of the CNT was, in fact, libertarian communism, the overthrow of capitalism.
So the CNT, in the period that we're talking about, in the run-up to the revolution and the civil war, so as you say, it was formed in the beginning of the century. It was by far the largest labor grouping in Spain, is that correct? I mean, was there socialists, was there communists around this time, post-1917?
Well, there was no communist party, really, to talk about. The communist party in Spain didn't really come into existence until the early 1920s, and even then it was, you know, it had very little influence at all. It was mainly, you know, a handful of middle-class ideologues. But there was a very powerful socialist movement, which had more influence in the central region of Spain, in Madrid, Castile, Leon, and also to some extent in the south. But the key influence was the anarchist influence, and that reached, I think, the numbers were certainly in the millions.
And so were the socialists competing with the anarchists? I mean, for the hearts and minds, and did they have a different vision of this future society? I mean, why would one join the Socialist Union, the UGT, as opposed to the Anarchist Union, for example, the CNT?
Well, it's difficult. It could possibly have been a cultural thing. It had to do. It certainly was much more influential in industrial Catalonia. The socialists. It was more in competition with the socialists in the central region, but it still managed to hold its own. But certainly within the big latifundist areas such as Andalusia in the south of Spain, anarchism had a much greater influence, mainly because of the nature of the class system in the countryside. I mean, you had landlords who were believed they had absolute authority over the peasants, and they treated them abysmally. So there was a much greater demand need for or call for revolutionary politics. And the organization that offered social revolution and justice was, in fact, the anarcho-syndicalist CNT, whereas the Socialist Party and the UGT, which was linked to the Socialist Party, offered primarily tinkering with the system.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. I'm Ramsey Kinnan, and I'm joined by longtime anarchist, author and publisher Stuart Christie. We're discussing the Spanish Revolution. So you mentioned at the beginning that the anarchists were prepared for the military, the fascist coup. How did they actually respond then, and what was why were they prepared and not the socialists, for example?
The socialists, the republicans, the liberals had in fact been, they were aware that a coup was in the offing. In fact, they'd been told some time beforehand.
So this was general knowledge then, that there's a coup was coming?
It was general knowledge, yeah. But the problem was that certainly once the army had left the barracks, the problem was for example, the head of police in Barcelona, Escofet and Companys, who was the president of the Catalan Generalitat, they actually refused to arm the CNT, who were the only ones who were resisting the army out on the streets, because to them it was a far, far greater danger they faced from an armed working class than from the army, who, you know, they didn't, it would have been far, far more catastrophic to have armed the working class, a revolutionary organization, than the alternative scenario of a military coup and fascism. Because remember, the slogan of these people was, in fact, the defense of tradition, family and property, something which, you know, was easily understandable to people from that background. And as I said, Escofet, for example, he was completely happy to arm the reformist UGT union members.
This is the Socialist Union?
This is the Socialist Union, yeah. And as he explained, he said, to arm the CNT represented an immediate or later danger for the Republican regime in Catalonia, of equal danger for its existence as a military rebellion. Companys and I, Companys being the president of the Generalitat, we agreed on the necessity of not distributing the arms because the CNT-5 was the dominant force. These armed elements, who undoubtedly would provide invaluable assistance in the struggle against the rebels, could also endanger the existence of the Republic and the government of the Generalitat. So he did everything in his power to stop the militants actually getting their hands on their weapons in the barracks. And because he knew that once the people had those arms, the cat would be out of the bag, and that the whole, you know, the monopoly of coercion, which is what gave, you know, which gives the state its authority, would be broken. And the consequence would be the collapse of state power.
So the cat did come out of the bag. The anarchist militias and the CNT organizations did raid the armories and physically fight back, and in effect, in many areas in Spain, actually defeated the fascist coup. This gave them some space to actually manifest the revolution. There are, of course, a couple of perhaps popular accounts of the revolution, of the people armed and how that came in practice. One, of course, is George Orwell's famous Homage to Catalonia, where he talks about the collectives, the industry in Barcelona, and, you know, famously he talks about the prostitutes collectivizing themselves and the waiters and the taxi drivers and whatnot. And, of course, some of the listeners here may have seen the film Land and Freedom, which showed some of the rural collectives and or the revolution in process. Beyond those journalistic and kind of post accounts, how did it actually, the revolution, manifest itself, both in the cities and in the countryside?
Well, there were three distinct points of view on the whole question of war and revolution. The first, and what was probably the majority view, was that the whole thing would be over in a matter of weeks, like the First World War. After all, I mean, a few days, it had only taken a few days to rout the army in Barcelona and most of the other industrial centres. And that the idea of social revolution and libertarian communism, as had been adapted and discussed by the CNT a few months earlier. So it was libertarian communism was an inseparable aspect of the struggle against economic and social oppression. So this particular group thought that the movement, the majority thought was that the movement should proceed immediately to socialize the factories and the land and the local communities. The second position was that which was held by the so-called notables, the leadership of the CNT-Phi. These were office holders such as Horacio Prieto, Mariano Rodriguez, and Federica Monseni, to name just a couple. They concluded that the whole thing would become a lengthy war, and they were opposed to implementing libertarian communism, social revolution, until the war was won. It's a very important point. So they opted instead for compromising alliances with the Republican bourgeoisie and with the Stalinists. Their belief was that such a strategy would prevent a situation developing wherein a victorious but ultimately exhausted CNT could possibly be overwhelmed by another political force, which had been more sparing with its forces, such as the Spanish Communist Party, which was really basically non-existent at the beginning of the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War. But that strategy, it just totally took them over, and it completely undermined their principles. And ultimately it corrupted and transformed what had been a tremendous instrument of the working class into who became just another rigid bureaucratic institution. But the third body of opinion, which is one that I subscribe to, and that was one held by militants such as Durruti, Camilo Berneri, Jaime Valius, and so on, they also anticipated a lengthy war because of the involvement of Germany and Italy, but they held that war and revolution were completely and totally inseparable. And only a libertarian revolution would finally destroy fascism, because to do so meant destroying the state, since fascism only means a certain position of the state, and all states become fascist when the threat to the privilege that the state protects, and to a degree also embodies, becomes strong enough.
Well, Buenaventura Durruti was, as you say, one of the famous anarchist militants, and was also very eloquent. And I would just like to quote from an interview he gave with the Toronto Star during the war. And he says, I quote, "I do not expect any help for a libertarian revolution from any government in the world. We expect no help, not even from our own government, in the Nationalists. But," interjected the interviewer, "you'll be sitting on a pile of ruins." To which Durruti answered, "We have always lived in slums and holes in the wall. We will know how to accommodate ourselves for a time. For you must not forget, we can also build. It is we the workers who built these palaces and cities here in Spain and in America and everywhere. We the workers can build others to take their place, and better ones. We are not at least afraid of the ruins. We are going to inherit the earth. There is not the slightest doubt about that. The bourgeoisie might blast and ruin its own world before it leaves the stage of history. We carry a new world here in our hearts. That world is growing this minute." Of course, Durruti did not prevail. He was killed shortly after on the fighting on the front with the eponymously named Durruti Column. And you had the incongruous scene of actually anarchists forming part of the government.
Well, yeah, that was the... that is a crucial problem, the whole thing. First of all, Durruti should never have left Zaragoza. The first mistake made, if you can call a mistake, was the decision not to take Zaragoza. And the reason for that was because they accepted the orders from the Generalitat, or the advice rather, from the Generalitat military advice, because they were given military advisors, two or three of whom came from fairly suspicious backgrounds, including the Rutte's own military advisor, a guy called Sergeant Mansana. And Saragossa had the largest number of CNT members in northern Spain, but because of the role played there by the General Secretary, who was a pacifist, and they decided to take a more peaceable approach to the resistance. They thought they could argue their way out of it with the military, but which resulted in a complete collapse of the arrest and slaughter of thousands of Sinatistas in Saragossa and the surrounding area. And the decision not to take Saragossa, which was a decision basically taken by the Generalitat, was because they knew that should the anarchist columns take Saragossa, it would then open up the whole of northern Spain from Navarre right up to the Basque Country, which would basically turn the whole of industrial Spain into a libertarian communist enclave. So, and it would give the social revolution a tremendous boost, which was the last thing that the bourgeois government, both of Barcelona and in Madrid, was the last thing they wanted, because they actually thought, I'm sure, that the threat from the generals wasn't particularly great, that they had been overcome. So the greatest danger, as far as they were concerned, was a revolutionary working class led by particularly by someone like Durruti. And as for Durruti coming to Madrid, he should never have allowed himself or the column to be talked into leaving the Aragon front with maybe 1,500 men, because they simply weren't needed. Madrid had over 20,000 militiamen fighting, defending the area. But it was the Federica Monseni who actually...
One of the anarchist ministers in the new government.
Yes, yeah. I mean, she just came out of nowhere. She was basically... She turned up at Barcelona's CNT regional headquarters, and she was co-opted onto the regional committee by Marionette, who was the regional secretary at the time. And she was also a very... very dangerous, self-centered woman. But it seems that the decision to call Durruti to Madrid, which is where he actually was killed, on the 20th of November 1936, was just a silly propagandistic mistake, but it may also have had more serious undertones, because the man who killed Durruti, which was this Sergeant Mansana I was telling you about, it strikes me that there's something very, very odd about the whole death of Durruti and the decision to bring him to Madrid, where ultimately he met his death, because he was the bulwark of the revolution, and with Durruti's death ended basically was the beginning of the end of the social revolution in Spain.
So you have a situation, so shortly after the successful resistance, at least in beating back the fascist coup and Franco's forces, you have in effect a dual power situation where the anarchists, who are in the vast majority of certainly of the active population, and as you explained it, a wing of whom are actively trying to pursue the revolution. The historian Gaston Laval talks perhaps there was 6 to 8 million people involved in the rural collectives. So how was it then that this massive social revolutionary force, very shortly beyond beyond intrigues about who killed Durruti, how was power taken away so that 6 months later there was in effect a civil war, then a civil war on the streets of Barcelona, and you had the anarchists and government forces, shooting at each other in May in Barcelona of 1937. What led to that then?
Well, what led to it was that they were dealing with very sophisticated political operators, particularly Compaños, who knew how to, Compaños was a lawyer, and he had dealings with the CNT, defending them during the dictatorship and the period of the 1920s. And, the process begins with the decision to, with the setting up of the Anti-Fascist Militias Committee. Gradually, the whole process begins of eroding the power away from the rank and file, the defense committees, absorbing them into semi-state institutions, such as the Central Committee of Anti-Fascist Militias Committee. Then you have, basically, within a matter of months, these popular forces, the militias, had been made illegal and had been co-opted into the state apparatus with militarization. And so by December, January, what had been a popular movement had been absorbed into the state apparatus. Then gradually, also during this time, the Communist Party had managed to build up its power base as a result of the influence of Soviet weapons and support and advisors, and they'd built up a very powerful political apparatus, security apparatus, both in the front and, more importantly, at the rear.
And then was there not the militarization of the anti-fascist war effort?
Well, absolutely. I was saying, from November onwards, that's when the whole process begins to collapse. And you have the loss of, basically a collapse of morale. Although people see Barcelona or tend to talk about Barcelona as being the epicenter of the revolution, a much more revolutionary body was the Council of Aragon, which was based in Caspe. And there was a lot of tension between the Catalanists and the regional committee of the CNT based in Barcelona and the Council of Aragon under Joaquín Ascaso, or led by Joaquín Ascaso and Ortiz in Aragon. And basically, these people were deprived of weaponry. They were deprived of logistical support. So there were internal tensions taking place within the anarchist movement, well, within the anarcho-syndicalist organization, all this time. And gradually, power was being accrued by a newly reconstituted state. And of course, the big argument was, first of all, we must fight fascism and then the revolution. What they didn't take on board was the fact that you had both of them were inextricably linked. You couldn't have one without the other.
My guest is Stuart Christie. I'm Ramsey Canan. We'll be back with him after this short break.